Good morning, Daniel Browning, filling in for Michael Cathcart here on RN. Welcome to Books and Arts on your ABC Radio app, however you like to listen. Today, a homegrown debut novel which tells the story of a mother coping with the aftermath of a traumatic event.
My own son was also shaken as a baby, and I thought it would be interesting to explore that in fiction and give that circumstance to fictional characters and see how it would play out in a made-up alternate universe.
And Feathering the Nest, celebrity milliner Richard Nylon tells us about curating the contents of a house. But first, we meet some of Australia's highest profile artists and hear about the flourishing in the desert from the remote community of Amata in the APY lands. Peace Be With You, performed by the Ernabella and Armida Choirs. Ernabella and Armida are two of the remote communities in the Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yuggetjantjatjara lands, the APY lands, in the far northwest of South Australia. Jala Arts in Armida is home to many of Australia's highest profile visual artists. And in fact, four of the finalists for the National Indigenous Art Awards, or the Telstras, come from Jala Arts. Now, to celebrate the success of their art centre, they've just published a beautifully illustrated book which showcases the work and the personal stories of the artists. Two artists join me now from Armida via Skype, Nurapaya Kaka, who's a senior law woman, and Nimity Burton, who's one of the finalists in the Telstras. Good morning to you both.
Yeah, good morning.
And also with them is Skye O'Mara, who's been the manager of Jala Arts for 8 years. Hi, Skye.
Hi, Daniel. Morning.
And also on the line, Hetty Perkins, independent curator, former senior curator of Indigenous art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Hi, Hetty.
Hi there.
Now, first to you, Hetty, can you kind of give us some context to the work being made out at Armida? We're going to talk to the artists, of course, but in terms of the reception of the work at Armida and what's happened, there's been a few revolutions in style and colour. There's been a real explosion from the APY lands.
Yes, certainly. Armida and Jala Arts in particular have really, I guess, led the charge, so to speak, of Anangu art on the national and indeed international cultural landscape. And of course, cultural practice to this region is nothing new. In fact, it's amongst the oldest in the world. But how this tradition continues and is manifest in amazing contemporary paintings as well as installations, sculptures, weavings is just incredible. And the innovation is unrelenting out of this community. And I think it's one of those things when you're driving through country and you arrive at Armida, first thing you see is this big sign, this township sign, which is so beautifully and vividly decorated, and it just makes you understand that even though you're in remote central Australia, you're actually at one of the hubs in terms of, you know, the art world.
So, Nurapaya, how did the Art Centre get started out there at Armida?
This is me, Nunmide, and she's saying that we started the Art Centre, but only the few of us working, and there's no famous or payment or no money, you know, only few of us. And then later on, there's women and men came to that art centre, very little.
Yunmidi, can I ask you a question? How important is Jala Arts for the community at Armida?
Jala Art is a big place for us, for everybody to come and work, not only our men or our women, No, there's a lot of young men, young people coming in, and we're working together in a happy place, you know?
Mm-hmm. Skye, Jala's at the forefront of Western desert painting. Why do you think Jala's been so successful?
Oh, I think that the elders of the Armada community had a really strong vision of what the art centre could be. And I think it's the commitment to Jukapa, to the cultural practice. People are you'll often see that culture is alive every day in Jala Arts. You'll often see old people instructing younger people at the art centre on Jukapa and how to tell these stories. But the Jala artists are brave, which I think really sets them apart. Everyone's pursuing different projects and new ideas. We engage in a lot of new media activities at the Art Centre. Nurapaya here is writing her own book. We have senior men and young men working on multidisciplinary installations that involve sound and light. And there's a strong painting tradition at the Art Centre, which also continues amongst all of these new adventures in art making.
Now, Hetty, we've got you there on the line. This is an extraordinary book, and you've written for this book. But can you just... It seems to me like there's been an explosion in colour. I know this is one of the oldest practices of art in the world in this part of Australia. But have you seen, as a curator, have you seen a different kind of way of representing country and all the things that they represent in their work, these Anangu artists from Jala?
Well, I think one thing that is very consistent, if you like, with this work is that it has that integrity and that passion and also that sense of celebration that it really is consistent with work from art centres. It's something that is a very important fact not to overlook, and I think as the ladies have referred to, this is a community initiative, this art centre, and I think that's something that permeates every aspect of everything that happens out of Jala. And of course, you know, the paintings are a wonderful celebration of that. They're so vivid, so sort of unfettered by any kind of commercial imperative. I mean, they're wildly and widely popular with collectors, whether they're public or private collectors. But I think one of the things is that you know, the artists haven't compromised their vision. You know, the older people who are tutoring, if you like, the younger people that are coming through, you know, one consistent thread is, you know, the people are very true to their country, true to their stories, true to their own visions. And I think that's something that really does, you know, distinguish this particular art centre. And I love a metaphor that Mr. Young has used with, he refers to the artistic practice of this region like a punu, like a tree, where he says the ancestors are the roots, those artists painting now are like the trunk of the tree, and the young people are like the branches of the tree and the leaves, you know, that are of future generations that are coming up. And to me, it's like, you know, these beautiful paintings and artworks are like the leaves of this wonderful tree.
Nyunmati, can I ask you, you're a finalist in this year's National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art Awards, otherwise known as the Telstras, for one of your paintings. Can you describe that work for me?
You know, many, many years I've been working as a teacher and long service leave I had, and then I choose to come to work at the Jala Art. Must be 3 or 4 years ago I started. And then I've done my paintings. Now I become famous, you know. And last 2 years ago, we went to Darwin for the Telstra Prize. That's my first trip. And this coming is the second trip for me to go to Darwin to see my painting up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud to do that, you know. There's 3 years or 4 years. That's not long enough for me, you know. I became the artist, and I came every day to do my painting because I've got in my head it's a chukurpa for me, and that's all I'm doing it. That's for me to do, coming to the Jala Arts to work, and not only the paintings, but I'm doing it for my family, and the families are really proud of me to do the chukurpa and the paintings and the country as well.
Now, chukurpa, for those people who don't know, and there may be some people in the audience who don't know, that expresses Nyomitsi expresses everything, expresses law, country, jokopa.
Law and culture.
It's hard to encapsulate. It's so all-encompassing. Skye, you've been out there for some years. What's the feeling at Amida? What have you noticed about the feel of this work? There seems to be an electricity in the work being made out there in the APY lands.
I think that what we're experiencing in Amida is reflected in all of the APY art centres. The family connections between all seven APY art centres ensures that the success that one art centre is experiencing grows throughout the region. And, you know, the APY art started in Ernabella a long time ago. I think that the art centres are alive at the moment. There's the highest rates of participation. There are young artists. There are young artists all over the lands that are stepping up and showing such courage in their art making. It's a really exciting time for me as an outsider. I feel very fortunate to be working on the APY lands at this time. I think that the art making is so dynamic and so diverse across the region. It's definitely a very, very exciting time here.
Nyomati, can you interpret for me? I'm going to ask Neera Pyre a question about her work that was in the Telstra Award up there in Darwin last year, a work called My Name is Jambi. Neera Pyre, what was that work about, My Name is Jambi? Can you tell us?
I made a Jambi. That person is a Jambi, and that's called Jambi is a grass, and I made it from the grass and made a woman, and I call it myself Jambi. My name is Jambi. And also I made a painting canvas, and in that canvas it's a story. Story and land, country, stories, all that. And Jambi was telling in that story, Chichi Chota means all the children. And I made a sound as well. Jambi is calling out. It's me calling out to children and say, come all you children and come and listen or come and see my painting. It's a story. I want to talk to you.
Now, Hedy, one question for you. That work that Neera Pyre was shortlisted for at the Telstras last year, it shows the innovation, even with the use of desert grasses in Jambi. There's an innovation that's happening across this swathe of country out there.
Yes, that's right. I think Jala Arts is really a centre of innovation in terms of working across so many different mediums. Neera Pyre's work, of course, at the last Telstra Award is a fabulous example of that. There's also, you know, installations that have been seen in the Adelaide Biennial and, you know, young photographers, Rhonda Dick coming through. You know, it really is, I think, a core aspect of the work that Jala Arts does is its engagement with contemporary life. You know, I mean, it's almost like the mediums become, even though they're very, you know, the artists are very technically accomplished across a wide range of mediums, it's really that it is just another way of getting this very strong, this very powerful story out there. And it is something that, as Skye mentioned earlier, it's those, you know, those deep roots that run through this country and connect these art centres, connect the people. You know, it's very much a community initiative. And I think that it proves, you know, one of the things that has made our culture, if you want to look at it in a kind of a national context, has sustained us for millennia and continues to do so, is that its ability to it's so strong that it can adapt to any situation, you know, absorb any medium, and certainly the Jala works are, you know, living proof of that.
We're almost out of time, but Skye, before we let you go from Skype there in Amida, there's a big festival happening very shortly in Adelaide, Tarnandi, the Festival of Contemporary Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art, under the auspices of the Art Gallery of South Australia. You're really busy out there, but tell us about the project. There's a men's project happening in connection with Tarnandi. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, sure. So we have our second artistic outcome for the Kulara Tjuta project, which is a project that operates with senior men across the region with a young Wiradjuri artist named Jonathan Jones, who's had a a lengthy relationship with the senior men on the APY lands. So the Kulata Tjuta project was a vision of Nirupaya's husband, Willie Kaika Burton, who wanted to create a new way of storytelling through the Kulata, through the spears. So he partnered up with Jonathan Jones, and they've made the artistic outcomes to date are just awesome. They're absolutely beautiful, and we have another one coming up with the festival that's fast approaching. This public artwork will be sitting outside the War Memorial in Adelaide. So I think it's a really the positioning of the artwork is going to be interesting as well. But there's young men and old men working on Kulata all over the lands as we speak. So that's very exciting for us.
That's brilliant. I think there's a camp dog out there that needs another bone.
Right.
Bless him. Look, Nirupaya Kaika and Yumiti Burton and the manager of Jala Arts, Sky O'Mara, thanks so much for being my guests today here on Books and Arts.
Thank you very
much
for having us. Thank you.
And Hedy Perkins in Sydney, thanks so much for being my guest, and thanks for letting us know about the context in which the work at Armada is being made. Hedy Perkins, curator and broadcaster, thanks for being my guest.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.
And the book, Beneath the Canvas, The Lives and Stories of the Jala Artists, is published by Wakefield Press.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. The sun is hot, the sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light, we need its heat, the sunlight that we see. The sunlight from our own sun's atomic energy. The sun is a massive...
Why Does the Sun Shine? By They Might Be Giants, who are touring Australia in November. Well, facts about the sun, our universe, and quantum physics are also present in the debut novel from Australian author Antonia Hayes. It's called Relativity, and it tells the story of Ethan, who's obsessed by science and physics, and his now very much estranged parents, Claire and Mark. And here's Georgia Moody speaking to Antonia Hayes.
Antonia, let's start with Ethan. He's 12 when we meet him. What's he like?
Ethan is a very curious little boy. He's obsessed with physics and the universe, and he's really interested in how the universe works and what puts it together and holds it together.
He's in Year 6 at primary school, and he's a little bit strange. He doesn't quite fit in with the cool crowd at school.
Yeah, he's a bit baffling to the rest of the kids in his class. They tease him a bit because he's quite scientific and likes to talk about, I guess, radiometric dating, things that normal 12-year-olds don't usually talk about.
Quantum mechanics, the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, that's the kind of thing that he's interested in.
Yep.
But Ethan and his mum, Claire, live in Sydney. Tell me about Claire.
Claire is a former ballerina, but now she works behind the scenes at a ballet company. So she stopped dancing after she had Ethan. So she's Ethan's mum, and she's pretty overprotective of him, but they have a very close relationship.
Yeah, it's a beautiful bond.
Yeah, she loves him quite intensely.
Now, Ethan's father, Mark, is very much absent from their lives, and after a few chapters of your novel, we find out why. Can you tell me what happened when Ethan was 4 months old?
When Ethan was 4 months old, Mark was accused of violently shaking him, in other words, shaken baby syndrome, and he was charged and convicted and sent to jail, and that's why he's no longer part of Claire and Ethan's lives anymore.
In the opening scene of your novel, we have Claire return and all of a sudden baby Ethan isn't breathing anymore.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a confusing scene because that's where I plant the reader, but then I take them all the way 12 years in the future very suddenly.
This is 12 years later. Mark, who has been absent for all of Ethan's life, is returning to Sydney to say goodbye to his dying father, and he upsets the balance in this little family that Claire has fought so fiercely to protect. Antonia, would you mind reading a scene from Relativity for us?
Yeah, so this is a scene when Claire is going to see Mark again after his return to Sydney. Claire's eyes struggled to focus on the road. The sky had suddenly darkened. Her head felt light. She knew this spinning feeling, this loss of balance, the vertigo of ambivalence. Years ago, she'd felt the same whirling confusion before. In the hours, days, weeks and months after Ethan was hurt, Claire had still loved Mark. She couldn't make that go away overnight. Rational parts of her mind knew that that was the end. Ethan came first. So Claire needed to make an impossible choice. She'd wanted to support her husband, but how could she, when the victim was her son? Cricket commentators on the radio yelled. Another wicket had fallen. She switched the car stereo off. Back then, Claire was angrier with herself than with Mark. What kind of person still loved the man accused of shaking her baby? There must be something wrong with her. She was faulty, deranged. Secretly, she held on to a small piece of hope that Mark hadn't done it, that everybody else had made a colossal mistake. An unspeakable amount of time passed before Claire let that hope go. Time wore it down. Medical diagnosis, family court, revoking Mark's rights, stripping him of parental responsibility, an apprehended violence order and a criminal investigation. Officers apparently knocked on his new door, arrested him, and then took him to the police station. Fingerprints, charges laid, trial date set. Mark had a new identity, the accused. Heavy rain started to fall and Claire turned on her windscreen wipers. The rubber of the blades squeaked against the glass. But it was still innocent until proven guilty. Mark pleaded not guilty. Claire wished his plea were true. Finally, the jury's verdict, guilty beyond reasonable doubt. She'd always thought her doubts were reasonable, but apparently they weren't. Without the safety net of doubt, Claire had no reason to keep clutching onto her hope that he was innocent. She had to open her palm, loosen her grip, and let those last particles of empty hope evaporate into the air. Oxford Street was covered in rainwater. Traffic lights lit the shining road green. As she drove past Centennial Park, her tyres hissed in the rain. She was almost there, surprised by how automatically she'd remembered the route. Claire thought of what Dr. Saunders had said, about how he could never be completely certain of his diagnosis. If what Mark said was true about shaken baby syndrome, if it didn't exist, that would mean Ethan was never a shaken baby. She was outside Mark's house now. Claire parked the car and loosened her grip on the steering wheel. Inside her palm, the hope was back.
Antonia Hayes reading from her debut novel, Relativity. Antonia, I know that you drew on some of your own life experience when you were writing this novel. Can you tell me about what prompted you to write this story, Relativity?
Well, I suppose the seed of Relativity did come from a real life event, even though the book is very much a work of fiction. So my own son was also shaken as a baby, and I thought it would be interesting to explore that in fiction and give that circumstance of fictional characters and see how it would play out in a made-up alternate universe.
What was it like for you to go back to what must have been a very traumatic time in your own life and reimagine that experience through these fictional characters?
It definitely wasn't an easy thing to do, but I guess it really helped me understand what happened and take a step back and see the whole picture.
Did you ever hesitate about writing a fictional story that, you know, was close to your own experience?
Yeah, I definitely was very hesitant to write this story, especially because, you know, there are some real life parallels. But by the time I'd started writing, the characters had taken on a life of their own and the story had also taken on a life of its own. And by the time I got to the end of the first draft, it actually felt very different from real life.
It had become someone else's story of this awful experience of having a baby shaken by its father.
Yeah, it stopped being my experience and my son's experience and started to be a story in its own right.
In this novel, you get inside the head of Mark, who violently shakes baby Ethan and gives him a serious brain injury. And even though your son lived through the same thing, you haven't demonised Mark. He's no monster in this story. What was it like for you to write from his perspective in this novel?
I'm a bit embarrassed to admit this, but I actually found Mark quite easy to write. And I guess because I was embodying this fictional character who had been accused of doing this, but I guess wasn't sure if he actually had done it, that I got to play with sort of ambiguity and duality and the way that memory can really fool us. And that was a lot of fun to do. So even though it was pretty horrific to imagine myself as a potential perpetrator of violence through this fictional character, it actually was, he was the most interesting character to write.
Antonia, I understand that this novel comes from a short course you did at the Faber Academy's Paris program. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I did a 4-day short course at Shakespeare & Co. Bookshop.
And one of the instructors was award-winning English writer Jeanette Winterson.
Yeah, we had two authors come and teach the course. So one was Tobias Hill and the other one was Jeanette Winterson. And her advice to us was, mostly her advice to us was about the power of verbs. But the other message she has was to write from the wound, I guess to move people with words. And those are the pieces of writing that resonate with people. So she advised us to try to do that. And I really took that on during that course. So I wrote a short story over 2 days with that in mind, and that is now part of the book. So it's the scene where Mark and Claire see each other for the first time in 8 years.
It's a tough call, though, writing from the wound. I mean, that's not an easy directive to give to writers. I mean, does that mean that their writing has to come from this hard place?
I don't think so. I think that it didn't exactly come from real life, what I wrote about in that story. It came from a feeling, and I think that, I guess, writing from a genuine feeling, even if you're using your imagination, is a great thing to do.
Ethan, the 12-year-old, is obsessed with astronomy and with physics. One of the earliest scenes in this novel is Claire and Ethan going down to a park near Glebe in Sydney and looking up at the night sky and looking for a meteoroid shower. And he knows so much about the universe and about physics and cosmology. And there's also a lot of physics metaphors scattered throughout this novel. What drew you to write about science?
Oh, lots of things. I have a bit of a preoccupation with physics, and I have for a while. Probably goes back to when I was at school, but my dad used to take me out. So we had our own special star watching stone, and he used to point the constellations out to me. And I always found that very grounding, that when I was feeling overwhelmed by things, I'd just look at the sky and find the patterns that the stars made. And then later I studied physics and maths at school, and I guess I had a bit of a natural aptitude for them, even though they weren't my passion. And I was always making connections between what I was studying in maths with what was going on in my head. So when I was in high school, I wrote some poems that are kind of based around trigonometry, but they're really about teenage heartbreak.
And did you have to brush up on your theoretical physics when you were writing this novel?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm by no means a theoretical physicist, so I had to learn a lot. And it was actually lots of fun to read lots of physics books and try and understand all this stuff, which is super hard to understand, and then translate that stuff into a story and not make it sound like a textbook.
Oh, no, it doesn't sound like a textbook at all, but you learn things as well.
I mean, I never intended for the novel to become a crash course in physics, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, when I was reading the novel, I looked up and I said, hey, guys, do you know that I think it's 99.8% of the matter in our solar system is the sun? Is
that? Yeah, I mean, that stuff's also exciting when you just go like, whoa, and, you know, only 4% of the known universe is actually, you know, matter, and everything else is antimatter and we don't even know what it is.
Antonia Hayes there discussing her novel Relativity with Georgia Moody. It's published by Viking. You're with Books and Arts on RN, on podcast, and on your ABC radio app.
We'll be right back.
Richard Nylon is one of Australia's best-known hat makers, or milliners if you prefer, and he's also a bit of a dandy in the fashion department. Now he's tried his hand at interior design. The Johnson Collection in the leafy inner suburb of East Melbourne is a treasure trove of beautiful objects collected by the antique dealer William Johnson, who left his house and its contents to the public. They've invited Richard Nylon to create his own fantasy interior at the House Museum, and he's let rip. Here he is speaking to Fiona Gruber.
Richard, it's delightful to be with you here in this fabulous house.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to actually talk about this, because this house is about stories, and I've tried to create a story in what have been my task, which has been wonderful. It's been quite a long task to do, but because there's over 2,000 objects, but it's been really fun, and try to mix a story of Mr. Johnson's life and my life and find things in the collection that reflect my taste and his taste and tell a story.
So here we are, we're in a room full of clocks. Is this clock on display normally, or have you picked it out especially?
Well, in the setup of the house, there's certain things you can't move. One of them is this beautiful long case clock against the wall there. So I thought with this room, I thought I would work around the clock as the object that predicated what the room would actually be about in the end. So I looked at all the technological things in the collection, which is clocks and barometers, and that led to thinking about time and the passing of time. And so I thought I'd incorporate a few metronomes in here as well, which will have feathers on their pendulums, which will fly, and it's sort of like the flight of time. And because this room is about fathers and sons as well, I put some barometers in here, and both of my grandfathers were on the land, as they say, out in the Western District, and they loved their barometers and would go and tap them at every opportunity so they could see what the weather was going to be. And there's another English long case clock that has been more or less gutted in a way, and I've got the carcass of the clock laying on the floor, which has got three Staffordshire fake clocks in it for people who couldn't afford a clock but liked the look of it. So they're inside the clock case, like the big clock is giving birth to little clocks.
Well, you really like things that look like other things, don't you? Well, let's keep moving through. Ooh, this is tool-tastic.
It is tool-tastic. You're right to call it tool, because it's not net. Net is another thing altogether. I make a lot of bridal headpieces, and in the bridal business that I have with Gwendolyn, Gwendolyn has her wedding gown business. I have my separate business of headpieces and veils and things to go on brides' heads. All of the tulle in this room has been used at some stage as a veil for a bride to try on in the shop.
You could call this the Miss Havisham room, of course, after the Charles Dickens character who was jilted on her wedding day and kept on wearing her wedding dress.
That's sort of part of it too, and this room is about relationships as well and what could have been. So in this room we have a little bride, but she is a music box and she plays for Elisa. She's Japanese, but on top of her goes a really beautiful little bride doll. It was an Avon giveaway in the 50s, late 50s, at an Avon party. My grandmother was given it or bought it for next to nothing at an Avon party, and then gave it to my sister that I didn't know, that's because I wasn't born. Her name was Deirdre in Irish, Deirdre, and Deirdre is associated with rain and storms and therefore tears. And so I thought, well, there's the bride doll that was given to a girl who had name like tears, that it's associated with tears and crying in Irish myth. So I thought I'd make this room about clouds and tears and relationships that have broken or never were, a bit like Miss Havisham. It's quite melancholy in a way, and the little melody of Für Elisa is quite melancholy as well, because it's in a minor key. She was a Spanish lady doll, but my mum redressed her as a bride doll for my sister that I never knew, so it's sort of like lost hopes. Perhaps this girl will be a bride at one stage, but she died when she was 4 and a half, so I never got to meet her. And so I thought I'd make this room about clouds and tears and relationships that have broken or never were. But I used to wind up that box, or my mum would wind it up so we could go to sleep, and I always tried to challenge myself to get to sleep before the music box stopped, and that was up until I was about 5.
So here we have a lovely marble top table in the passageway in the front hall, and you put a bit of kind of fake grass.
Well, it'll be real grass. When the exhibition opens, it's real grass. The pigs and the sheep and the bunnies will have real grass to stand on. It's my origins and Mr. Johnson's origins as well. He was born the son of a country town person. I was a country land person, I guess, but he escaped from the country. So there's lots of grass and cows and pigs and rabbits and a lovely estate picture of what Mr. Johnston would have liked to imagine was his country seat in Scotland.
Oh, and I see, when you said he imagined it was a seat of Mr. Johnston, I've now seen that it says Alva House, Stirlingshire, the seat of Mr. Johnstone Esquire, so spelt differently, but I suppose he could imagine that it was enough. Quite a long distance from the cobbler's son from Lilydale.
Yes, and the thing is, too, the sad part about, well, one of the sad things about this picture is that the house was used for bombing practice. So, it got blown to bits in during the Second World War. But anyway, it's no longer there. But, yes, Mr. Johnston used to stand beside this and hope that people would notice that the name underneath the picture was very similar to his. And, I believe he came from a landed family.
So where did the Nylon family come from, Richard?
Well, they were illiterate Irish ancestors, let's face it. They weren't educated, so they came out here after the potato famine.
Were they the O'Nylons?
Well, no, they were the Neylons, N-E-Y-L-O-N. And when I first started being noticed in the fashion world, people would mispronounce the name and they would misspell it. Which is fair enough, because there's not that many of us N-E-Y-L-O-N about, so I thought I'd just change it to Nylon, which is pretty easy to remember, and, N-Y-L-O-N. And Bob Buckingham, who was in the Fashion Design Council of Australia, he would call me Wretched Nylon, just for a bit of a funny laugh, and I thought, oh, okay, Nylon it is.
But you probably would never think of using nylon in... Or maybe you do. You probably do use nylon.
I do use nylon thread a lot, and look... Anything that is makeable into a hat and is light enough to be used as a hat and for headgear, I will not refuse. It's a gleaning way of making hats where if you find it and it's found useful, it's one of my problems as well because I've just got boxes and boxes full of stuff. But it's also good in a way with this curation because I get to go through all the boxes of things and think, oh, yeah, that'll be useful.
Well, you have to be a hoarder if you're creative. I think that's my excuse anyway. Well, now we're entering a bedroom, and there's a lovely four-poster bed with wonderful gold hangings and just a whole load of hounds.
This particular part of the, I guess, the installation isn't finished. What will go there in the back of the bed, above the bed head, is an image of Louis XIV as his incarnation as Apollo. So that means a big sun face, and the sun face is made of gold knives and forks. Louis XIV, on the 1st of September, at any rate, will be 300 years since he died. And I love French Baroque music. So there will be a music component in here as well, which will be music written for the Louis XIV. So what this room represents is either the lever or the coucher, where Louis would be escorted to bed. And when he got out of bed in the morning, there was a ceremony as well, where the people who were most favoured got to, say, help him on with his slippers or help him on with his day shirt, hand him his wig when he got older, he got bald. And he had music playing. And so it was a big ceremony at Versailles.
Now, I read that, Louis XIV, fabulous dresser, but your inspirations for dressing are more much later, Beau Brummel, early 19th century, and then you said you were a cross between Beau Brummel and an Edwardian undertaker.
yeah, sort of. I did have a big phase of black and white at one stage, and Beau Brummel was basically buff, navy blue, black, very white linen. But my style has changed a little bit over the years. I've sort of embraced more colour. Like Louis XIV, I like wearing high heels as well, because he was only 5'5", so...
You're not wearing high heels now, though, but you're wearing a lovely Prussian blue velvet coat, and I must say, I'd love that waistcoat, because it's terracotta and gold plaid, and with spots on it. It's like, what shall I wear today, check or spots? Damn it, I'll wear both, yeah.
So, no, I've got my flats on at the moment, but when I go out, to events and things, I'll throw on a pair of heels, and the higher the better, really. I found out my maximum height of heel with the flat sole, at any rate, is 6 inches on the heel I can get away with walking in. And I like a really thin heel as well. But that's because I just like to be tall and skinny, and, the heels make me taller and skinnier. We've got actually a pair of heels in the exhibition upstairs covered in peacock feathers.
Well, I've got to ask, do you sometimes rue the fact that you were born in the late 20th century, that in a quite a sober time for fashion for men, definitely, and do you wish you were born in a more flamboyant era?
Not really, because I can pick and choose from every era I want and dress that particular way or take elements from that. Because when I dress, I try to avoid costume as such because I like fashion and I think that fashion needs to have references to different times to make it relevant to now. Plus there's penicillin and dentistry and, yeah, there's no other time like now for clothes. I can just pick and choose from whatever era I want.
Yeah, penicillin never goes out of fashion. Now let's move into another room.
Let's go into... Yeah.
Now we're at a dining room table covered in lovely 18th century glass by the look of it, or maybe even 17th century glass.
There's a real selection here. In fact, this table is, I've repurposed it as more or less a coffin table, which is an Irish thing to do at a wake. You had a table that you put the coffin on and everybody'd sit around and toast the corpse's health. And I've made a body out of glass. And this also refers to another French king, Charles VI. And he's laying on the table in the form of glass because he suffered from a mental illness that people nowadays call the glass delusion, where people think that they're made of glass and they'll shatter if they're touched.
Have you just made that up, Richard? I've never heard of that.
It's a wonderful thing. I mean, you know, mental illness is, I mean, if you're not suffering from it, it can be very, very interesting. And, yeah, the glass delusion is actually a thing, and Charles VI suffered from it. There was also a French princess at one stage who imagined she swallowed a glass piano as well.
I noticed I was looking in your website and there was a great hat that was in the shape of a white lacy skull. Do you get off on the whole gothic thing?
Look, as a child of the 80s, how can I put this without sounding morbid? The gothic has a great deal of romance. The idea of the beauty of transformation and leaving this world and becoming transformed into something else. I also like the way that different cultures, and especially European culture, dealt with death and how they dealt with life, because life, death was very much a part of life then. So I'm not a morbid person at all. You know, people who know me know that I'm pretty, you know, I can be pretty flippant and happy-go-lucky, but there's always that undercurrent of gothicry there.
I think that's a pretty full answer.
Yeah, I do carry on.
Oh, now this is a yellow room. This is a room that's got a kind of a lot of japonnerie.
Yeah, japonnerie and japonisme and a bit of schwanniserie as well thrown in. This room is sort of an ode to my lovely friend Gwendolyn that I've known for over 20 years. And it's really things that I chose from the collection that I felt she would like. And then I've decorated it with items of Gwendolyn clothing that are really beautiful and that Gwendolyn chose herself, actually, because I thought I'll choose everything in the room and I'll let Gwendolyn choose the clothes she feels best represent her and her brand. And I also put in various display cases here. There's a vitrine, which is a little display table, I guess, more or less, which has got what I call the bold brides in it. So they're the brides who come to us with knowing exactly what they want. They're having perhaps a big wedding and they're fun and effusive and very forthcoming. And then behind the wardrobe door, I've got another case thing there, and that's got miniatures hanging in it, which are the shy brides, which are the ones who don't really know. They know they're getting married, but that's about it. They don't know what dress they want. They don't know whether they're having their hair done. They don't know what their flowers will be like. The only thing they've decided upon is the husband-to-be and the wedding venue. You know, they haven't decided what they want.
Do you know, did Mr. Johnson find love?
That is something that I wanted to explore in this installation, because he was very guarded. He was very fond of his creature comforts and collecting and things. He sort of built up this collection around himself. And it's hard to say. That's why I'm trying to explore through this installation is did he actually find somebody that filled him with the joy and the kindness of love, or did he not? That sort of hangs over this installation a bit like, well, downstairs, like the cloud room and the tears room. But a very good friend of mine knew him quite well and said he was spiky. He was difficult to get to know. And he was a bit of a rogue as well, apparently. But I have to pick what I can from his life and then present it in a way that reflects my take on it. I guess it's the only thing I can do.
Well, it must have been great fun doing this. Richard, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Nylon speaking with Fiona Gruber, and Feathering the Nest, Richard Nylon meets William Johnson, is open in Melbourne until October. Now, check the Books and Arts website for details, abc.net.au/rn. But if you go to our Facebook page, you can also see the splendour of Richard Nylon's take on the Johnson Collection. Now, it's a fabulous house in Melbourne, but you do need to book if you want to visit. That's it for Books and Arts for now. And remember that you can join us anytime you want on your tablet or smartphone. Just download the ABC Radio app. It's free, it's so simple, and it'll transform the way you think about radio. Well, it's not every day we hear about a new Arthur Miller play. The great American playwright died in 2005. This morning at 10 on Books and Arts, we hear from the director James Dacre, who's researched and restored The Hook, which dwells in the corrupt and cruel world of struggling American dock workers. Now, as you know, we make this show at 10 a.m. and we repeat it for you at this time the following morning. It's good night from me, and I'll see you at 10 a.m. for more Books and Arts.